Well, welcome to the Old Red Bud Radio. Carrie Allen Fields here with you, and I've got a guest in the studio. Mr. Bill Price is here to talk about his new album.
Hey, Carrie.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
This album is something else, man, and I've been bragging on it already on the show, so folks have an idea. We've been playing some tracks from it.
Well, thank you.
It's called With the Eye of a Skeptic. It's got a subtitle, too, doesn't it?
Yep. And a few other likely stories is the entire title.
Yeah, perfect. Well, it's a concept album, and we'll be talking about that a little bit. We ought to just go ahead and play, I think the kickoff track would be excellent to start with, man. You agree?
Sounds good.
One up and over, staying underground.
That was Bill Price, Junkman, and we got started with Hear Me Out, the perfect kickoff track for an album, I must say.
Thanks, Kerry.
Obviously, you agreed.
Yes. Yes, I stuck it on there first. It just seems to fit.
You know, I got to tell you, man, this thing top to bottom, man, even the graphics, the liner notes you've gotten notes written on each song that just give some wonderful insights to what was going on in your mind when you wrote these things. You know, it really is a concept album, isn't it? Everything's tied together. And
yeah, I was trying to be a little more narrative on this record than, you know, some of my other stuff is a little more obscure lyrically. So I was trying to be a little bit more toward what I kind of call the traditional singer-songwriter, what you think of. It's not that every song is a story or has a plot, but a couple of them do, but just a little clearer and more in that direction. So it was kind of an attempt to be more narrative and have the lyrics be pretty important about the whole thing. So that's why Hear Me Out is kind of important as the first song. It's kind of say, hey, you need to listen to the words.
yeah. You know, a lot of the songs on this album, one thing that, you know, the way they flow one into another and stuff, they paint different pictures. You're really good at, I get the mental image going, man. I'm sitting there and I'm just kicking back with the headphones. I get a picture in my mind of what's going on in the tune. I'm sure it might be different to someone else, but, you know, to me, that's valid.
It seems like, one of my big influences, like a million other people, is Bob Dylan. And you know, one reason I like his music and his lyrics, they're very visual. And so, and when you just read a line, it needs to be kind of visual, because that just helps people. I don't know, it's just a more interesting and creative way to listen to music, I think.
Yeah, it's more accessible, isn't it? I mean, it makes it easier for people to connect to it.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, and like I was talking about the other style of writing that actually I kind of like more, if I was to be honest about it, is to be a little more obscure, but sort of have an idea or an emotion or something that you're trying to convey, but not convey it literally. That kind of lets people create more of what they want out of the song. You know, it's like if you look at a painting and you're not totally sure what it's supposed to mean. So it kind of means something different to each person
right.
who listens to it. So if I'm honest, I have to say I really kind of like that style of writing better. But I wanted to go in the other direction and be, you know, more traditional singer-songwriter on this record. So I like that style too. So maybe there's some overlap of what's happening here on this record. I don't know.
Well, there's some writers who are really good at just like stringing together lines that play well, where there's a certain cadence to it, or that's just syllables, really, man. And then it sounds like it has this bigger-than-life meaning, or you can crawl inside of it and assign your own meaning to it.
Right.
And it doesn't mean it had a dang thing to do with what the writer intended.
Right.
You know?
If you listen to, like, I think a good example of that is Paul Simon. If you listen to early Simon and Garfunkel, it's like those songs are what I would kind of call traditional singer-songwriter style. It's like, you know, some people say, well, that sounds like he wrote those in English class. You know, they're all thought out and they're obvious metaphors. And then later on, he sort of scrapped that. And if you listen to him talk about his songwriting, he doesn't talk all that favorably about those early songs, as great as they are. But you listen to stuff like with Graceland,
mm-hmm.
That's much more obscure and... but it's all so visual. It's like, you know, everybody listening to those songs on Graceland starts figuring out what they mean to themselves. And so...
Yeah, and that's, man, it's perfectly valid, man. It could be something. Good music's like that. You should be able to, you know, have your own meaning to it, you know, and have it be, you know, relevant to you, man, if no one else.
Right.
You know how Paul Simon, I read in interviews, you know how he wrote that later period stuff? He would record the music first, get up in his house, stand between the two speakers, the two studio monitors or whatever, and stand there and riff on things and use the voice and the singing more like an instrument.
Right.
Where, and you know, and he'd find this line that just fit like a, like it was a sax line or something, you know.
Right.
And then write it out. Oh, that worked, you know. And he would stand there for hours and do that until the song came together, and you know, kind of a stream of consciousness thing going.
Yeah, and what you're talking about, the different syllables, and I mean, if you listen to, like, you know, Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man, you know, those words just sound good.
Yeah. David Byrne's really good at that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, they talk about certain lyrics being more singable.
Right.
And sometimes that's when things come out, when you're writing certain words, they just work right with, you know, if you're trying to hold a note out, you know, some letters... M is kind of is a hard word to, you know. I've had songs with M at the end of the word, and you just don't hear it because it's just not a word that you can.
Yeah, I know exactly.
Say very
what you're
loud.
Talking about,
loud. Yeah. So there. I think. I guess to get to your point, I think there is a lot to the way the words sound. Sometimes they look great on paper too.
Well, there's some good lyrical poetry in here, man, and it just reading the lyrics.
Thank you.
Yeah, I read the lyrics first before I sat down and listened
really?
To the album. Now, I've heard you perform some of the songs, so I did have some idea what the melody was and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I did that intentionally because I wanted to check the lyrics first.
Well, that's cool.
And, yeah, I mean, I'm glad I did it that way because once you've heard the song, you know, you're not going to hear it, you know, be able to read it the same way again.
That's interesting because there's some times where I've bought albums and I'll listen to sit down like I used to, sit down on the couch, put the album on, start to finish, and I'll read the lyrics with it, and sometimes I'll get done and I won't have really liked it. Then I put the lyrics aside and I just listen to it as a song, as music, and I don't concentrate on the words so much. And it's like all of a sudden I like it better. I think sometimes you can overdo the lyric part. I mean, it has to hook somebody in a way with the music, I think. Otherwise, you might as well just write it on paper.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's kind of an overgeneralization.
It works better with some songwriters than others.
Yeah.
I do that with Elvis Costello albums when I first get them. I'll read the lyrics first if I can. And it's a good experience doing it with him.
I should do that.
You know, I think that comes from my days where, man, you're old enough to remember where we go and buy albums.
No, what are albums?
And well, you pull it out, man. Remember The Ritual, man, reading the liner notes and who played what and... reading the lyrics and stuff.
It was a ritual. I mean, going to the record store was, I mean, I still get a buzz out of that. There's just not any good record stores left other than there's a handful. I shouldn't say there aren't any, but that whole process is, you know, there aren't hardly any Dylan albums that have the lyrics in them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there were any albums until like 1985.
Right.
That Empire Burlesque album, I think. Somebody out there will correct me on that. But I think that's the first time he actually had the lyrics in the album, which is really interesting since his music is so lyric-based, you know?
I've known people that sat there and were obsessive about it and wrote out every word to, you know, It's All Right Now, Baby Blue, or whatever, you know, just off the top of their head because they'd listened to it so many times. And it, you know, man, it's like a religion to some folks, you know? And you know, if it feeds your spirit, that's okay.
That's right. That's what it's all about.
I ain't mad at him. Do you mind if we play Blue Period Blues next?
You can play whatever you want.
There you go. Welcome back to the Old Red Bud Radio. We're here in the studio with Mr. Bill Price talking about his new album with the Eye of a Skeptic. And that song right there, In a Flying Dream, I think it is kind of come to the surface as being one of my favorites because I keep going back to it. And a lot of the lines have stuck with me, man.
Oh, thanks. I was very happy with how that song turned out. It's got some of my favorite lines in there. I was very proud of this. Probably the shortest line I've written was just the line about Custer was a poet, just because it just, to me, it just said a lot of things that I kind of believe in. And an interesting thing about that song, which really has nothing to do with the recording or the lyrics, was the guys in the band, and we were all talking about Flying Dreams, and I'm assuming you've had them. And hopefully people listening have had them, so they know what we're talking about. And for me, they were, I don't have them very often anymore, but when I was a kid, I had them a lot, and it was so easy. I would just kind of twist my torso, and I just lift off the bed, you know, and I was flying, man. And so we were talking about that, and Michael Graham, the engineer that did this record with me, he said, yeah, I was at a point where I could self-induce flying dreams. I thought, well, now that's pretty cool.
That's some Carlos Castaneda kind of stuff, man. That's out there.
And Paul Holdman, who played guitar on the record, he said, yeah, I had those dreams, but I always had to run to take off. So, you know, we kind of laughed about that. You know, picturing Paul, you know, running. He has kind of a Flintstone thing or something. It's like, and there he goes, you know, taking off. But so, and then actually the guy, you know, that I did some T-shirts for kind of related to the album, and was at the place that was silk screening them. And the guy that was actually working the silk screen press, he was talking about Flying Dreams, because that was one of the shirts, has the Flying Dream lyrics on it, and he's like really into Flying Dreams. So it's kind of interesting, just that, you know, aside from the song itself, that everybody sort of connects to that. You know, it's kind of talking universally, you know, it's talking about history and big things, about war and Napoleon and the Great Wall of China and all that. But then at the end, the guy that's singing it, whether it's me or whoever, it's about, you know, an individual sort of relationship. It brings it back to a personal level.
Yeah, it is a song you could crawl into and end up being the protagonist. Well, what should we play next here, man? We fire up another one. Then when we come back, we'll talk about some of the talent you brought in to do this thing. Because you've got some local heavyweights, man, and there's some real performances got turned in on this thing. But
I'll let you pick.
You're going to let me pick?
I've heard them all, Carrie, so... multiple times. So
if you don't mind, man, I'd like to play Waterfall. Would that be okay?
That's excellent.
You got it. That was Henry's War, and before that we played Waterfall, and Bill Price is here with me to talk about all this good music, man. Some excellent performances got turned in on this thing. Grover Paradell playing the cello.
He played on Henry's War at the beginning and the end, and actually I think everybody in the band was on that particular song. I mean, the way the album sort of was structured, the way we recorded it or arranged it, you know, all the songs were written, you know, by me on acoustic guitar, basically. And then Paul Holdman, who played guitar and bouzouki and cittern, basically worked his parts out with mine so that they were, you know, complementary. And he just did a great job. I mean, it's amazing. We were talking, Michael Graham... And a while back, about how long the project had taken, and the fact that we've been listening to it for so long, and Michael said, you know, I've been listening to this stuff for 3 years, and I never have gotten tired of Paul Holdman's guitar parts.
That is really saying something.
Yes, I hadn't gotten tired of him either. So, and then Jamie Reed played drums and percussion, and Jeff Stone played bass, mostly acoustic bass. The only electric instruments on the album is he played electric bass on a couple songs. But that was kind of the core band, was the four of us, and we recorded all these tracks basically live. I didn't sing them, but we all played together. And a couple of tracks, Gary Bull played accordion on, and he came in on those particular days and played along with us live. And then, so basically that was the setup. And then once we kind of had those arrangements in good form, we added some stuff. We might have overdubbed a bouzouki part or a harmonium or something on a chorus. But then we kind of got to the point where we needed a part in Sticks and Stones. We were talking about that, Michael and I. He says, you know, it's so rhythmic that we need like a B3 or something that's just straight. Right. Everybody's just so rhythmic. And I had wanted to put a cello on Henry's War. And I said, well, what if we put a cello on there? So that would be really cool. So through Gary, I met Grover. And I said, well, heck, if we're going to use him on those two songs, maybe there's another one. So we ended up putting him on In a Flying Dream. And when we added Grover to kind of the core band, and then Stacia Demas came in and did harmonies and just sounded so good, I kind of felt like that really pushed the whole record up like to another level. I mean, I felt like it was pretty solid to that point, but when those two kind of came in, it was kind of the icing on the cake. But that's kind of basically how the process worked, you know, getting the songs together and the arrangements and
stuff.
There's
probably a little bit of it being a pleasant surprise and having to take on a life of its own where it was this whole other thing you hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, and I, you know, it was funny, you know, we were listening to Stacia, and I kind of said on some song, we kind of picked the songs that she would sing on, and kind of told her, well, maybe try something on the chorus or whatever. But if she had some other ideas, you know, we certainly listened to those, and I think we kept some of them, and some we didn't. But everything she did, the stuff we didn't keep wasn't because it wasn't good. It's just because it didn't make sense, you know, in the arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
But she sounded so good, I was kind of sitting there, you know, thinking, well, I should just have her sing the whole record, you know, and just get me off of here. So, but I was just really pleased and, you know, honored that everybody played on that's on there. They just did, you know, I thought they did a great job.
It sounds as though you had a pretty democratic approach to, you know, input and encouraging people to be creative and let them stretch a little because, you know, it's not like you handed them charts and said, here, do this.
Right. I mean, the approach was to do kind of a singer-songwriter album, mm-hmm. and it needed to be acoustic, but I wanted to have a band because I like playing with a band and I like to jam a little bit, you know, and so I wanted that feel and it just gives more variety. But with that in mind, it's like we kind of knew it was going to be acoustic in some direction on what people would be playing.
Right.
But as far as the actual parts, you know, they were pretty free to come up with. And sometimes we had to go back after and fix some things that we sweated a lot of stuff and fretted over a lot of parts and really put a lot of extra effort into nuancing. And I remember one time Stacia came back, to sing two words that I didn't ask her to sing when she was there. And, you know, a year later we're mixing the song and it's like, well, why didn't she sing here? And it's like, well, I guess I didn't ask her to. So she came back and, you know, for two words, but it, you know, so we were really focused on the details on that. So I hope it shows.
Yeah, it paid off big time.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I'm not shy about telling you so, man. It's the truth. When I first started listening to this, I think I told you, man, it was all about the lyrics. As I've been listening to it with repeat listenings over and over again, different parts come out and different performances. You know, the cello, man. I've always loved cello, and I love the way Grover's got a feel for this, too, man. He could work the cello around a vocal line real well.
Right.
And there's a kind of a phrasing thing going on there, man. And, he's good at that. And cello adds so much in support of the song.
Well, we needed somebody that, you know, I'm going to overgeneralize cello players here, which is terrible because I really don't know very many, but I think a lot of them are classically trained, and they need mm-hmm. charts, and they, you know, Grover can just improvise and create on the fly, and you say, well, you know, maybe this or that about what he just did, and he can change it, and, you know, that's what we needed, because that's kind of how we approach things. So it was great that he was willing to do it, and the little part he did in the bridge on Flying Dream, is was really beautiful, just really minimal, but so tasteful, and I guess that's part of what his thing is. He's just really tasteful.
he understands when not to play in intervals and the in-betweens. And,
you know, it's a very human-sounding instrument.
Yeah, it does, you know? Have a voice, yes.
Yeah,
you're exactly right.
And I think the accordion is, too. It's real textural, and it's real, It's real warm, and so yeah, he was a great addition, and you know, everybody just played great.
No, everybody on this album, man. I've had a few whoa moments listening to it, like whoa, or where I caught something I didn't catch, you know, the time before when I listened to it. But we got time here to play one more. What do you think would be the logical song to conclude with?
Well, let's see. I'm looking at the back of the CD here. I don't know. I'm going to take the easy way out. I'm going to let you decide again. Depends on how long. We were talking about Red Cloud before we started doing the show.
That's, you know, Red Cloud.
It's a pretty long tune, though.
It's close to 9 minutes, but I was listening to it on the way here, and I love it, man. And I knew exactly what picture you were alluding to in the lyric there. So let's go ahead and close it out with that.
There's a long story to that one, but you have to buy the CD to read the liner notes to hear that, I guess.
It's all in there, folks. Hey, you got a website, don't you?
I do indeed.
Speaking of getting the CD.
It's BillPrice.info.
Perfect.
And it's actually on CD Baby now, too. You can buy it on there. But if you want me to get all the money instead of the middleman, you can go to my website.
I like the sound of that, man. Nothing wrong with that.
Thanks for having me, Kerry. I really appreciate it.
Oh, man, thanks for coming in and doing this. And we'll keep playing this thing in the weeks ahead, folks, and months ahead. You can count on it. Well, here's Bill Price from his new album, With the Eye of a Skeptic, Red Cloud.